Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns.
Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we have a very special guest. We have Michael Biedenbaugh. And he has written the book, Reviving Our Republic, which is so good that I think every citizen in the country needs to read this. But anyway, Michael, is a preservationist, community leader, and political thinker dedicated to revitalizing America's founding principles. As former president of Preservation South Carolina and host of Reviving Our Republic, he combines practical experience with historical insight to address modern governance challenges. I'm going to leave the rest for him to explain in person. And welcome, Michael.
Hello, Hillary. How are you?
Good. So you're also a show host, right? You're Reviving Our Republic is your show. It's a podcast or a show?
Well, it's a YouTube channel. It could be set up as a podcast too, but I don't have the staff to organize that as well. So I just do a YouTube channel and have some really great interviews on there. But it's, you know, all about talking about saving the Republic and how we can do it.
So what kind of guests have you had?
Well, I had a lot of guests on about a year ago. It was people like my family doctor, who's in the national movement for uplifting primary care. You know, the family doctor who takes care on a primary basis is almost an extinct species now through the corporatization of our healthcare system. And so he is working hard to do that. So I've had him on. I've had my local pharmacist on that is part of a national board about independent pharmacies and how they're being threatened. And then just other folks, everybody from a fellow named Joe McGill, who runs something called the Slave Dwelling Project to try to save slave dwellings in the landscape and say that these places were here, and all the way to Chad Conley, who is head of an evangelical movement in certain areas of the country that I grew up with. So, you know, the whole thing was about uplifting South Carolina, because I don't think anybody can understand the history of America without understanding South Carolina's impact on it, whether from the Revolution to the Civil War to all things in between. We helped define the challenges that America has had. And I like that perspective. I had it called Perspective at first, and then I named it Reviving Our Republic to focus more on the book and that theme.
Really? All right. Well, we'll get into South Carolina later. All right. So where did you grow up? In South Carolina, I'm assuming.
Yes. I grew up on a farm in outside of a little town called Prosperity, South Carolina. And I grew up with a very strong sense of place. You know, I knew where my Revolutionary War ancestor lived, which was only a mile and a half away from where I lived then. And every one of his descendants, my ancestors' direct line, lived between where he lived and where I lived. My church was helped built by my grandfather. And, you know, my grandfather built the mule barn on the square in Prosperity, where he sold mules and wagons, of which I have one of his wagons in my backyard.
Wow.
So those sort of things were really important to me. And I sat at the knee of my grandmother, who told me the stories her grandfather told her of when Sherman came through town and poisoned all the beef. And, you know, these type of stories that are indigenous, that are unique to a rural landscape like here in South Carolina, it really made an impression on me. And I grew up honoring that.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have one brother My mother and father were wonderful folks. My best friend was my grandfather. And it was really a nice childhood. But I also grew up at a time that is foreign to my own children. I have my children are in their 30s, but I grew up in a world that where the last vestiges of Jim Crow were still in place. We had two black families living on our farm that had been living there for two generations. And, you know, that concept. And one of these folks, you know, still used an outhouse and a hand pump well until I was 10 years old in 1971. And, you know, I grew up with that and then saw how society had transitioned into changes that happened. And how communities can change through positive intention of making things better for everybody. And that was really impactful to me.
Wow. Okay. So did you go, I guess you went to like high school locally, and then did you go off to college? Where did you go?
Well, I did go local high school here. And then, like everybody, I felt like I was on the conveyor belt of what everybody did. I was supposed to go to college. But, you know, I was just not that boy that just really was a studious kid. My older brother was the brainiac in the family who would sit there, you know, the old Jeopardy in the 60s,
yeah,
where, you know, they actually had little cards sliding up. We would watch that. And my brother, we had every answer correct. That's who he was. And so everybody thought I would do as well at school as he, but no, I was the class clown in the back of the class. And so when I tried getting into Clemson, I didn't get in. They wouldn't let me. My grades weren't good enough. So I went to a small Baptist college called Anderson College because it was 20 minutes away from Clemson. Where all the friends went. Every one of my friends got into Clemson except me. And
I just have to ask, what was, when you were the class clown, what was like a good like thing you did?
Oh, it was no one thing. I just, you know, it was, I will say, I think I was the lovable class clown to the teachers. I wasn't the mean-spirited guy.
Right.
But, you know, but I also wasn't the testosterone guy. I mean, I grew up loving reading books. My dad would take me deer hunting, but I hated getting up early in the morning and sitting around waiting on a deer to walk by to shoot it. So I would always take one of my books and pretend I was in the deer stand while I was really reading a book. And I collected butterflies. You know, I love butterflies and I still have them here in my office.
If you love to read, why were you a bad student?
I loved to read what I wanted, that I was interested in.
Okay.
And the regimental system of school just didn't fit for me. You know, I loved the history classes.
Yeah.
Because that was a lot more imagination and a lot more creativity in discovering the mystery of what was behind us in our past. But math and French class, the only reason I joined French class was because they took a trip to New Orleans. And let me tell you, a 17-year-old from Prosperity getting on a bus and going into New Orleans for 3 days. Yeah, that's why I was in the French club. But poor Miss Aveline Rhodes had, you know, she caught me 3 times cheating in French class.
Wow.
And she never did anything bad with me. So she was a sweet lady.
Oh.
But
so, all right, you were saying, let's see, local high school. Okay, you went to Anderson.
That's, you know, I went to Anderson, and I remember I was just doing so bad, and I remember making the decision, and it was probably one of the most important decisions of my life, was realizing I am different. I can't pretend to act like everybody else. And I dropped out. Nobody had dropped out in my generation or before. You know, this was in, you know, 1979, 80, when, you know, I still had my grandparents' generation never went to college. Well, my grandmother did, but for the most part, that generation, folks born in 1900 in rural South Carolina, did not go to school.
Right.
And here I was going to school, and I dropped out. I had so many older people just telling me how disappointed they were in me. But within 2 months, three of my friends dropped out too. Ooh. They said, Mike, you gave us permission. Thank you. Because they weren't ready either. The regimented school system just did not do us service and we weren't ready. And so I had a choice. I'm like, what do I want to do? Because I knew I wanted to get out of prosperity. I knew there was a bigger world here. And I was conscious enough, as much as I loved it here, that I would not grow beyond what I could here. And I knew I had to go somewhere. And I decided to join the Navy.
Wow.
And that's when I joined the Navy. And that was my awakening, was being in the Navy for 5 years. And it was funny, when I got into the Navy and the scary aspect of being thrown into boot camp and my head shaved and marching with a bunch of other guys I'd never seen in my underwear doing push-ups, and just this whole reformation, they try to remake you within a night, you know, it basically break everything down. And I was just sitting there distraught and going, oh my gosh, what did I do? What did I do? I want to go home. And I this was the Navy. This wasn't the Marines. I mean, this, you know, and I got in my kit that I was read was a book called The Blue Jackets Manual. It's about that thick. And it was everything a young sailor should know about the Navy. And I opened up, and the first page I opened up to was a picture of the brand new nuclear powered guided missile cruiser USS South Carolina. And I'm like, that's home. I'm going back home, but I'm going on that ship. And I got on that ship, and I served on that ship for 5 years.
Wow. Yeah. So what did you do? What was your MOS or whatever they call it?
I was a quartermaster. Now, in the Army, quartermaster is supplies. But in the Navy, quartermaster is navigation. Oh. And I had a dear friend before I went in the Navy really mentored me before I went. And he said, during World War II, he was a quartermaster. And he said, it's the best one. You don't get much training outside. A lot of people were joined to be electrician. And a lot of my electrician friends made a lot of money being an electrician after the Navy. Mm-hmm. But he said, the quartermaster is one of the most important jobs because you're the one the captain asks, where are we? Excuse me. And so I'm sitting there on the bridge with the charts. I learned how to do celestial navigation, to shoot the stars at night. It was very magical and mystical in a way. And it was really the one thing I loved about the Navy was it had embedded traditions that went back before America existed. Mm. And when I was there, you know, recently, they had this big thing in the military about shaving all beards and all of that stuff. Well, when I was there, the Navy still had beards as part of their tradition. And they had actually said they were going to get rid of them. And it was a huge blow up in the Navy about that, because we saw that as what set us apart. But it was wonderful. I mean, there's nothing better for a young man or woman, of course, but there's also an issue of young men finding themselves, who mm-hmm. they are, how they fit into the world of being a mm-hmm. provider and the man to take care of their household. And I'm sitting up there, and I tell you, there's nothing more awakening than sitting on the top of a mast of a nuclear powered guided missile cruiser in the middle of the Atlantic and having all horizon around you and just listening to the ocean. And it was an amazing thing, and it helped form me who I am today.
Wow. I can't really imagine. I think it'd be a little freaky just having water all around, but
that's... Well, what's really freaky is when you're in the North Atlantic and all that water is 60-foot waves, and you have to keep the ship aim front, or you would potentially capsize if you turned sideways. The winds were hurricane force winds, and we were in a North Sea storm. And the waves were so tall, the ship was 600 foot long, and the waves were so tall that there were big swells. They weren't crashing waves, they're out in the middle of the ocean. They were mountainous swells. And as the ship would go down one swell, I'm at the helm because I was a helmsman also. You look out the windows, and it's just a wall of water. You don't see the top because the little narrow windows on it. And then it goes up. and then you see nothing but sky. And it was going up and down like that for 2.5 days.
Oh, so where were you? You were going...
We were in the North Atlantic. We were doing operations. I don't know,
like if the waves are, the swells are coming.
Just, we're just keeping steerage and staying as clean. You have to keep enough momentum to be going forward to keep the ship steering, you know, because you have to be have movement to steer a ship. So we were going like 10, 15 knots into the winds and just riding the waves for 2.5 days.
Was everyone sick?
There was a lot. I was fortunate not to. But what I would do while I'm up at the chart desk or at the helm, I'd keep my eye on the captain, and the captain did an amazing job of just sitting there and looking as calm, just making sure everybody knew everything's fine. This is okay. And, it was something. It was really something. Now, a funny thing is, you know, us sailors were bored out in the middle of the sea, and we're out there for 2 or 3 months at a time. The front of the ship is where all the anchor chains are. And there's this big room that's like 40 feet tall in the front of the ship where all the anchor chains go. And people would go to the front, and when the ship would go up, and then when it started coming down, they would jump up. And as the ship would come down, they would float in the air because the ship would come down, and you're floating in the air.
Wow.
And it's kind of like they do when they get people used to no gravity on the Vomit Comet for NASA. That's kind of what it did. And unfortunately, two guys, they mistimed it. They hit the bottom so hard when the ship came back up, they broke their legs and court-martialed. So
really,
at once, it was not in the room, but those guys got busted with a broken leg. So the things boys do to have fun. And then, of course, we were stuck in a Hurricane David outside of Nassau one time. And the waves, these waves were tall and crashing over the ship. And the ship would go down into the waves, and water would flow over the top of the front of the ship. This is a 600-foot-long ship where the edge was 40 foot above the waterline. And these waves were crashing over it, and the whole ship would shake. It was amazing to be on the edge of that type of natural thing and to know that this is a routine thing that ships in our Navy do every day, all over the world. It's amazing.
So they don't try to avoid the storms. They just go through them.
Well, they do. We had no choice with ours. And the storm they thought wasn't as bad. We had to get into Charleston Harbor and from Nassau because our governor was coming to visit us and we were doing a homecoming into Charleston. Our home port was Norfolk, Virginia, but our captain wanted to go visit Charleston. And we had to get there because everything was lined up. And he said, full steam ahead, go through the storm. And we did. We went through Hurricane David, went through that stuff. So
now, do ships ever capsize and get wrecked and stuff in the... No.
It's amazing the ballast. One time our ship tilted 45 degrees. And let me tell you, 45 degrees doesn't sound much when you're sitting there looking, but you're trying to stand on top of a deck at 45, most people are on the side of the walls because they slide. So we had a few of those things happen.
But no one went over the edge.
No. 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 Wow. No. We were very...
I feel like I'm on the ship now. I'm a little seasick right
now. Yeah, but she was an amazing vessel. And I really hated it. As soon as I got out, in the mid-90s, I mean, I got out in 87, and then in the mid-90s, I heard it had been decommissioned after only being commissioned for 20 years.
Oh.
A nuclear-powered guided missile cruiser, and they scrapped it.
Oh.
And it was really sad, but but we still have a reunion. Facebook has been wonderful for just us keeping in touch with the shipmates, so we keep in touch with each other a lot.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So once you got out, you were there for 5 years, and then what? Then what?
And then
you were like 23 or something at that point.
Yeah, I was, and I realized. Well, I was 26 because I went in a little late. I was 21 when I went in.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Right. And because I worked with my dad on the farm a little bit after I dropped out of school, and I while I was in, I got fascinated with Russia because everywhere we went, we had Russian ships around us all the time. This is the height of the Cold War in Reagan's administration. And so we had Russian ships everywhere we went. There was these little tiny fishing boats pretending to be fishing boats, but they were filled with satellite antennas communicating out what was, you know, where our ship was and our position. We had Russian ships trying to mess with us and play around with us before, you know, to see if we would break formation. It was a constant thing, but I became fascinated with Russia and reading the history of it. So when I got out, I went into international studies and Russian-Soviet affairs. I started learning Russian. My thought was, I want to be the guy on McLaughlin Group or some of these talk show things. Everybody remembers McLaughlin Group back in the 80s and 90s. It was my favorite show. I want to be that guy sitting there talking about policy and how to deal with Russia. And I lived over there for a summer and speaking Russian with families. I lived with families. I was there the last year Gorbachev was in power. I was expecting Gorbachev to be overthrown because I knew enough about Russian history to know that there would be generals that would send him to the Crimea to get away, to get him out of Moscow. And they did that, but I missed it by 1 year. I wanted to be there when it happened so I could write about it for my local paper. But it was fascinating. It was a fascinating time. I am still in touch with my Russian friends to this day through WhatsApp. I talk to them. And I have a very, it was an amazing time of what was going on over there then to see that place opening up and how they were embracing Americans. And
so what year was that?
1990.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. 1990. The wall had come down. But Gorbachev was still in power, and the Berlin Wall had come down.
Right.
And so I did that.
Were you working, or you were just, were you actually working?
I was still in school. No. I was fortunate in that my school, you know, while I was in the Navy, I didn't spend a dime. So when I got out of the Navy after 5 years, I had a savings account in 1987 of $50,000. And I'm like, I'm going to go to school. That's what I'm going to focus on.
And they didn't pay for it?
No, it was. I went in right after the GI Bill went away.
Oh.
I was in right after the GI Bill went away. And when I got out, they brought the GI Bill back. I was in that one window where there was GI Bill. Wow. So, I got married also while I was in school. I met my first wife. She lived in New York. I moved to New York and we started a company that she had started, but I've started working with her on it. And then for the next 15 years, we ran a national promotion merchandise company. And we did a lot of adventures with that, but we moved back to Prosperity to run the company out of Prosperity. And that's when I got involved in local politics here. I got on this town council in Prosperity. I was on the planning commission. I was chairman of the Board of Zoning Appeals in my county. I enjoyed that citizenship duty. You know, the duty of a citizen is to be involved and take leadership roles where you can. And so I enjoyed that a lot, and I did that. Then, and that was leading up till our... Then we, you know, we just were living too fast and doing too much work. And we ended up having a divorce and we separated around 2000. I've been married. What's that?
Did you have kids with her?
Yes. Yes. We have two wonderful kids now in their 30s. Yep. In their 30s. And since this isn't going to air, I can say I'm going to be a grandpa.
Is this your first one?
Our first. Yes.
So when is he or she due?
May.
Oh, May.
May, but the communication of all of this, you know, it is now first part of November. They're going to let everybody know at Thanksgiving, and so everybody, you know, so we're safe to talk about it now. But it was and so my son and his wife, my daughter-in-law, her parents, it's their first grandchild. So we're all just suited hands and going, yes, this is what life's about. Bringing in new humans and giving us hope for a good future.
Yeah. Beautiful. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. So you got divorced. Did she go back to New York?
No. She stayed here and kept the business and did various other things.
Okay.
My current wife is a teacher, which, you know, my great-grandmother, mother, and grandmother and mother were all teachers. I taught for a while in between stuff of running the company and divorce, and I taught for 3 years in a private school. And I teaching runs in our family, and I appreciate that. And this Anya came into my life 16 years ago, and she's just an amazing teacher and educator. And yeah, so it's good.
What does she teach? What grade?
She originally taught history and social studies and English, language arts, whatever term they call it now. But the past 10 years, she has been teaching multilingual learners, and she has a master's in multilingual learning, English as a second language. And here in South Carolina, we have a lot of immigrant children that have come here to work in the peach fields and a chicken plant. Many of them came across illegally, and we have these amazing little children that she takes care of and teaches. And you could see God in their eyes. I mean, they're these wonderful little children that want a better life. Mm. And she is there as their protectors in a way.
So what languages does she speak?
Well, Spanish is the primary one, but it's also just, you don't necessarily have to speak another language to do the multilingual learner course, because you're basically trying to help these children learn English and start speaking English. But she took Spanish, and she almost speaks it fluently, because you have to respect a person's language for them to understand, for them to want to strive to speak yours. Mm-hmm. And it helps. And she actually has, the interesting thing about this, and this is really important to remember, many of these children are coming out of areas like Guatemala, Honduras, and a lot of these are the indigenous areas. I mean, this is why these people are leaving, is because there's always been a caste system down there with the European descendants who run the countries and the indigenous folks who have basically over centuries been turned into peasant class. But some of these people don't barely even speak Spanish. They still speak Mam and Mayan languages. So, you have a six-year-old coming in, and she has a rudimentary understanding of Spanish because you have to exist, but their primary language is the indigenous language. And so it's fascinating, but to see how much these children want to learn, they're the best students in the school. In this little rural, small town, South Carolina school, these kids want to be something. And it's amazing to see that in their eyes. And she's been doing a great job. This is her last year. She retires after this.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, thank her for taking care of those kids.
Yeah.
All right. So you were a teacher, you were a politician.
And then a preservationist.
Okay.
So,
was that a job, or was that just a passion?
Well, it was always a passion. I mean, ever since I was a kid, whenever my mom looked for me when I was little, there was this old house in the woods behind our house. That's where she would always find me. Old places always spoke to me as a child. I believe we bring some things with us into the world, mm-hmm. some interest and some outlooks that are born into our DNA. I don't know where it comes from, but I always grew up fascinated with old buildings. As a boy, I drove my mom and dad crazy. Well, my mom loved it. Drove my dad crazy. We're on vacation. We go through an old town. I want to stop and look at the old buildings. So, trying to get to Gatlinburg. Right. I always loved it. I was always involved on the museum board and doing things like that. And, in the 90s, when I had my marketing company with my first wife, I heard about a group forming a statewide preservation group. So I put myself, I was able to approach them and got on the board. That group was called Palmetto Trust for Historic Preservation. And Palmetto being the state tree of South Carolina. And so Palmetto Trust. And it was kind of like the National Trust for South Carolina. It's what the National Trust does, we did for South Carolina. And I was on the board. And then things happened. We opened an office in L.A. I had to get off. Well, after the divorce, I approached them because I wanted to start a consulting company for restoring old houses. And I called them up. This was in 2007. And I said, so I want to start this consulting company, but I want to see how we can work together. And they said, well, Mike, actually, we can't find a director. We're getting ready to shut down. We've been looking for a director for 2 years. So there you go. I knew what I was going to be doing.
You found one.
Yep. And I got in there and they were broke. They had only $30,000 left in their bank account. And they had owned two old houses that were falling in and nobody was taking care of. And I made it my mission to make that place work. And I ran it as CEO for 17 years. And
that was like a job that you got paid?
It was a full-time job.
Wow.
And I traveled the state and I saved buildings. I raised money, millions of dollars. I did everything from saving the little ex-slave Gullah houses on Dufusky Island. And the Gullah were the enslaved folks that had been freed that still had a lot of Africanisms in their language. And they've been very isolated on the Sea Islands of South Carolina. And their houses that were built in the 1890s, 1900s, that were falling in. So I started a campaign to save them. And at the same time, I'm trying to save an 800-square-foot Gullah house on Dufusky. I'm also trying to save an 800-ton Italianate mansion in Greenville, South Carolina, that we had to move or it would be demolished.
Oh,
and that was in 2015. And that was the highlight of my time there. It was amazing bringing purpose and place back to, because old buildings make us as much as we make them, right? I mean, they communicate to us who we were. They're repositories of all the energy of the hands and love and families that went through them. And it just breaks my heart to see them just neglected and thrown away because we lose something of ourselves when we do that.
Yeah.
And then we also started something called the Sacred Spaces Fund. A fellow joined our board named Bill Fitzpatrick, and he had written a book called Sacred Places of South Carolina. And that was about old churches all over South Carolina, where he donated the book to us. All the proceeds of the sale of the book came to us, and we started a fund to save abandoned churches and to help restore old churches. And so that was one of the last initiatives we did. And before I retired, my father had a lot of property management stuff. He was in his 90s and I was needing to help him more. So I had to retire and go work with him and help him.
All right. We need to take our commercial break and then we'll continue and get to your book and all that, how you helped your dad. So we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Got it.
Parents and teachers, imagine a classroom where every child belongs, where kids are seen, known, and part of a real community. That's the world Kikori creates. Kikori isn't just another program. It's hands-on, playful, and filled with activities kids love, all while building skills that matter for life: confidence, kindness, resilience, and teamwork. Kids learn how to regulate themselves, connect with others, and discover the joy of learning that lasts a lifetime. And it works. Schools using Kikori have seen behavioral referrals drop by 25%, and teachers save hours of planning time. Whether you're a teacher building a safe, positive classroom, or a parent wanting your child to grow socially and emotionally, Kikori makes it easy to bring these life skills into everyday learning. So if you're ready to help kids grow stronger, kinder, and more confident while creating a community where every child belongs, visit kikoriapp.com. That's K-I-K-O-R-I, where kids thrive together.
Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary Show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary Show and Getting Real Movement is all about, being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon, my courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, in case you feel stuck in your life and want to get inspired. How I came out about my no sex life and my marriage, and my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring social-emotional learning to your children, just like Mike was talking about that his wife does with these little kids, go to KikoriApp.com and check it out. It is an amazing company that brings community, belonging, just a sense of wonder to these kids, and they learn to love learning. And then, you know, thank you to all our sponsors. You'll see their banners going by underneath. Thank you all for making this show possible. And of course, my books as well. You can find them all on Amazon under Hillary Burns. And now we'll bring Mike back to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So you helped your dad with his property management.
Yep.
Okay. So what year are we talking now?
2016 is when I started working with him part-time. I worked with Preservation South Carolina part-time and did both part-time until he passed away at 94 in 2020. And, well, he lived an amazing, wonderful life. And he died on his terms.
Yeah.
You know, my mother, unfortunately, lingered from dementia and you know, she wasn't able to. So I was thankful Dad was able to say goodbye and be himself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I was, you know, it was a wonderful gift that he was able to do for himself. Mm-hmm. But then I just working that and I got into my profession of real estate, since I did so much, because with Preservation South Carolina, I basically created a nonprofit realty company, to where we would find old houses, I'd buy them, the organization would buy them, we'd restore them a little bit, then put them back out into the marketplace with people living in them, put a purpose back into them. And so I was so distraught at how many real estate firms had no idea anything about old houses. Our country is such a throwaway society. You know, after I left Preservation South Carolina, I realized my preservation focus, because it was always, I used to do videos and I always end them place, purpose, preservation. Because those are the three things that I think are so important for us to live as citizens. Know your place, know your purpose, and to preserve what matters. Whatever that is for you as a citizen, yeah. I think that's important. Well, I realized that was turning into what I thought was our republic and our nation. Mm-hmm. And my knowledge of history led me to see in the tea leaves serious issues of fracture that I think we're in danger of dealing with, and a dysfunction, what I think is now turned into a dysfunctional society. So I decided to run for Congress, and in doing that, I've been working on a book and thoughts for years, and that's where I came up with Reviving Our Republic, 95 Theses for the Future of America. And when I was coming up with the idea, I grew up in a Lutheran area. My ancestors, my name, Beatenbaugh, is a German name. These folks were Lutheran. Now, during the Second Great Awakening, they turned Methodist. But, so I grew up with that. And I'm enough of a history nerd that I just thought it was a cool thing to do.
Well, if you get this book and the thoroughness and the amount of knowledge that you had about so many different topics, I was like, how the heck does he know all? I mean, I don't know if you love research or what, or if you just have a photographic memory, but the thoroughness of this and all the different topics that you covered was amazing.
Well, I wanted to couch the reason. I mean, my 95 theses, just so everyone understands, the 95 theses comes from the parallel of the monk Martin Luther nailing 95 theses on the church in Wittenberg to push back on the indulgences of a corrupted 16th century Catholic church and wanting to reform it. And so I use that same parallel of what I think today we're dealing with, a federalized government that has been shifted away from it being as functional as it should be, as it used to be. And so that's kind of where that came from. And the subject matter of it, the actual, content was inspired by George Washington's farewell address.
Right.
And George Washington, I believe, was the most important man to ever exist in 18th century America, because we would not have our nation the way we have it without him.
So was he the brains behind all those ideas? Do you think
he wasn't the brains, but he was the father figure, military commander, leader that helped create loyalty to the cause, that helped lead that. He was the general over the revolution, and he was the leader and president of the Constitutional Convention. He was so admired for his sense of duty and the way he approached responsibility. But I will say that the one incident that shows who he was something called Newburgh Conspiracy. And not a lot of people know about this. But in Newburgh, New York, after the revolution was won, the British were still in New York City. They had not left yet, but it was pretty much over. In a little town of Newburgh, New York, up the Hudson River is where Washington's army was kept. And the soldiers had not been paid. And Congress, being as inefficient as most Congresses are, the Continental Congress, well, it wasn't Continental, but it was the Congress of the United States, but they were under the Articles of Confederation. And he was, and they weren't paying him. And the soldiers were getting ready to mutiny. And they had gathered in a barn to petition Congress that if they didn't fix it, they would march on the Congress and take over in Congress and install Washington or somebody. I think General Gates wanted to be the one in charge. He was an usurper, to get rid of the Congress. And Washington heard about it, and he came into the room, and just through his force of personality and leadership, was able to dismantle it within an hour. And in that moment, he broke the cycle that almost every revolution where a people has overthrown their existing government turned into a civil war among the revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. Countries all over the world. Because when people are trying to tear down something, you tend to attract demolishers. Demolition experts, but not builders.
Right.
And so people tend to then start fighting over the spoils, and a civil war occurs. Washington forestalled our, what I believe, inevitable civil war 4 score in 7 years to give us a foothold of constitutional legal basis and help to survive that conflagration that we barely did. So we would not have the United States of America as we know it if he hadn't had that force of personality to be in that room and stop that from happening.
Wow.
Yeah.
So a lot, I think it was at the beginning, you know, all the warnings and don't let this happen and don't let this happen. And those are all the things that are happening now.
Yeah.
What?
Well, just as a little bit. Yeah,
passionate factionalism always serves to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. Factionalism against the citizenry will, with, you know, anyway, all of that is exactly what we have now. I mean, what do you think that there's hope for? I mean, do you think anybody will listen to this and bring us back to what our founding fathers envisioned for the country?
Well, I wrote the book hoping so. I am committing myself to communicate my perspective. I have a unique perspective, a unique life that I've lived, and I've collected all this stuff and passion, and it's my duty to share it. So here it is. It's being shared. And so I'm, and when I talk about Washington, I want to make sure we talk about the fact that all of these thoughts came out of his farewell address, because after he was in office for 8 years and he voluntarily gave up power, which was a remarkable feat in itself, he saw the quirks and foibles and concerns of what our nation could turn into and lose the liberty we had fought for. So he gave a farewell address basically saying, here's what I think are issues you need to be careful of if you're to keep this republic. I consider it, if I use my preservation work, a maintenance manual on the structure of government they had created. And we have totally ignored the maintenance manual, especially from the 20th century, with the challenges of global conflict, the institutions we put into place to deal with global work that we took responsibility for. And basically, in a nutshell, at 32,000 view of it, I truly believe that we cannot be a major global superpower with our money being the primary money focus of the world, as has been set up since World War II. And those systems needed to make that work are counter to the systems that just allow a free republic and individuals to live in freedom and individuality. The same things don't work for each. And I think we've tried to do that, and the traditions of our republican form of government kept us going for a while in 1950s and 60s, but it started fracturing apart then. And what I did was I looked at all his warnings and I saw the different decisions we had made in how we did things in representation and how the Senate's elected and all of these that went away from the checks and balances that kept our nation checking with each other.
Right.
And so that was the root of all of that.
So, I mean, it's great to write a book.
Yep.
It's great to know that your suggestions would work, but then the question I have is how do we get more people to read it? And I mean, like, even
it's the big question.
Right. Better control over education and health. I mean,
it's about a conversation. So here's the thing, the condition we're in now with a huge mistrust of how the government works, mistrust of each other, the weaponization of conflict, you know, in a republic, democratic republic like ours, conflict is part of it. You're supposed to have conflict.
Right.
You're supposed to have faith that those on the other side are in the best interests of the nation and have honest disagreements. Those days are almost over.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they have to be over, because they've been engineered by what I believe the corporatized political party system that is all about funding that comes from a narrow sector of supporting systems that they use to support themselves. And, you know, I think a lot of these things can be tweaked and fixed over time. It'll take some discussion. But I know when I ran for Congress last year, and I had this book finished by then and was using it as my platform, I had as many liberal, left-leaning liberals in the room as right-leaning conservatives. And they all were agreeing with 80% of the book. And that tells me this is the right way. Because I don't talk about policy necessarily. There's a few little policy things I deal with, but it's mostly all about structure. It's about how we can govern ourselves to ensure the right policy for the right communities, you know, in choose federalism, and tried to give the argument that this is how it worked all these years, and the slippery slope has happened to where many of those mechanisms have been eroded away to where they're ignored. And I'm just trying to remind folks, they're still here. Let's start using them. And I really appreciate you having me on, because this is how I'm trying to get the message out. We can do this, and hopefully inspire people to see that, wow, I can do this. And either people in Congress, you know, I've sent the book to a couple dozen members of Congress, and handed it personally to the Democratic leadership as well as the conservative leadership. I know they have the books in their hands. But it's unfortunately, things don't heal except or change except with a pain balance of when it gets too painful, you have to alleviate your pain. And I don't know if we've gotten into enough pain yet, but it will take that. And I'm hoping that it won't get so bad that it totally falls apart, because there's a lot of trajectories this nation can go in.
Right.
I believe it can heal from all of this, and that's what I'm focused on. But we have to remember, it's not necessarily that it will. We have to take responsibility for the ship and guiding us. And you have to have knowledge that it nothing's in the cards to say it will always exist. Mm-hmm. We have to take responsibility for that.
Now, have you ever seen that the country has been in this kind of position before?
Yes. Well, I haven't seen, but my knowledge of history.
Right.
I mean, and we're getting ready. Ken Burns is getting ready to do his 250th, the revolution, which is going to be so eye-opening to people. My knowledge of the revolution is, instead of this noble thing we look at of patriots overthrowing an evil empire of Britain and becoming liberty, we were a chaotic nation that our revolution was a civil war where we were killing each other. In South Carolina, where many of us believe the revolution was won because of the fighting in the upcountry here and the bleeding of Cornwallis's army that led him to get out and end up getting caught in Yorktown and surrendering. It was a civil war up here. In fact, half my ancestors in my ancestral line were loyalists. It was a terrible conflict where it was not all cut and dry. My ancestors who were loyalists, they had perfectly good reasons of not siding with the powdered wig dandies of Charleston because they didn't like their stamps or tea being taxed. You know, they had perfectly good reasons for that. So it was a complicated time, but it was a bloody, terrible time. And it shows what happens when civil society breaks apart and what people can do to each other. And then, of course, we have our own Civil War and the Reconstruction era that happened after that. And then the Jim Crow era that came into South Carolina. America can be a violent place, and that violence shows itself. Well, civil order doesn't control the norm. You know, we used to grow up watching old Westerns. Yes.
So we have about a minute left.
Oh.
I'm just realizing, oh, no.
No, I am so sorry. Well.
No. This has been great. What would you like? I mean, I know people, It's going to take a book. It's going to take a movement. It's going to take people caring about our nation. You know, caring. And what do you want to leave people with?
That there
Where
is,
can they get the book and all that?
That's it. I mean, I appreciate, you know, it can be found on Amazon.com and also on the page Reviving Our Republic. If you want to see all my other thoughts, I have my podcast and everything as well. But it goes into why I believe this is important and the point. But the book, share it with folks. There is a way we can. We have been around 250 years. We can be around another 250 years if we start taking responsibility and realize we can take care of the nation that we love and live in liberty. We just have to work with it. And I'm looking forward to being part of that movement.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your brilliance, your commitment, your perseverance, and for everything you've done for the country and South Carolina.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.